While you're eating your lunch, we're going to get our panel started. And we're going to do what they used to do in the press club, which is to have a staggered start over lunch. But we're going to stagger this a little bit differently than they did. Now, the first panel, you know, did the easy part. The first panel told you how we got into the mess we're in. We're going to do the tough part. We're going to tell you how to get out of the mess we're in. Many of you may have remembered the days when we had something called mad cow disease. And there was a story making the rounds at that point of two cows talking to each other, and one said to the other, "Are you upset about mad cow disease?" And the second cow looked at the first and said, "Why should I be? I'm an elephant." Well, the confusion about what is what is going to be rampant in days when we have trillion-dollar bailouts piled one on top of another, and when the line between what is a federal entity and what is a private entity is blurred to a degree never before seen in our country. We have a number of highly qualified panel members to talk to us about that. We're going to start, however, with a panel member who is on a pretty tight schedule and is going to have to leave in a short while. We're fortunate to have Congressman Jeb Hensarling with us. He represents the 5th Congressional District of Texas. He is the second ranking member of the House Budget Committee. He is the ranking member on the Financial Services and Institutions. He's the deputy whip for the minority party, and he will soon make it a majority party, he guarantees, sometime before you get the next luncheon here. And he's also a member of the House Republican Economic Stimulus Working Group, and most important, was formerly affiliated with my friend Phil Graham. Please welcome Jeb Hensarling.
Well, first, thanks for the kind introduction. Please, all of you, continue to eat your lunch. As a member of Congress, I'm used to speaking and having absolutely nobody pay attention to what I say. This would not be any different. These are obviously interesting and challenging times in which we live. I'll relay one true story to you that as we labored in the fall over the original bailout package, we had to do something which is a little unusual, and that is have congressional sessions over the weekend. I'm the father of two small children, a five-year-old and a now seven-year-old. They're used to seeing their dad on the weekends in Dallas, Texas. So during this time that we had to be in session, I spoke to my daughter on the telephone, and she said, "Well, Daddy, why aren't you home?" And I said, "Well, Daddy's having to work." And she said, "Well, what day is it?" And I said, "Well, Claire, it's Saturday." And she says, "Well, Dad, it's Saturday here, too." So, "Well, yes, Claire, it is." And she said, "Well, I thought you were supposed to be home." I said, "Well, I know, but we're having to work. Daddy's having to work in Washington, D.C. today." And then she said something truly profound, and that is, "Daddy, is Washington, D.C. still in America?" And after everything that is going on in the nation's capital, out of the mouths of babes, it sometimes makes me wonder, indeed, is Washington, D.C. still in America? I want to thank all of you for participating with the Federalist Society. I also want to thank my dear friend Wayne Abernathy for serving on this panel. I'm glad that I get to leave before he speaks because I know he'll show me up. We labored together with, we were both on Senator Phil Graham's staff together at one time. I want to thank also Alex Pollack and Bert Ely, wherever Bert went, for all of their help for myself and other members of the Republicans on the Financial Services Committee for their contribution into this debate. I know that earlier today you had comments about what got us into this economic pickle in the first place. I didn't have the benefit of hearing those, so I'm going to take the liberty of very quickly giving you my own theory because my ideas about what we do going forward are based upon my ideas of how we got here. I do want to take President Obama up on his challenge in the State of the Union, quote, "It is only by understanding how we arrived at this moment that we will be able to lift ourselves out of this predicament." As I have tried to study the economic challenge that we have before us, I have concluded that there were at least five key factors that contributed to this financial recession and panic, four of which I believe were the result of government involvement. Number one, a highly accommodative monetary policy by the Federal Reserve. And I'm not going through this to try to demonize anybody. It's amazing how clear our vision is with 2020 hindsight. But it also lets us know that regulators do not always get it right. Number two, federal policies, no matter how noble in intent, that ultimately were geared towards putting people into homes who could not afford to keep them. Number three, the congressionally granted duopoly of Fannie and Freddie. I believe if there's any but for cause of the economic crisis, it was Fannie and Freddie who ultimately ended up securitizing the lion's share of the subprime and Alt-A mortgages. An anti-competitive government-sanctioned cartel of our rating agencies, where, again, federal policies limited competition among those that the market trusted to rate these securities in the first place. And then, frankly, investors in Wall Street had more than their share of greed and foolishness and creating unsound underwriting. Some of which was incented, some of which was cajoled, some of which was mandated, and some was just absolutely done by themselves. Now, in this debate, I'm sure you've heard that many have a different opinion, that the reason that we're in this economic pickle is because we've had a quarter century of deregulation. That is not my reading of history. I think you might be able to argue that Graham Leach Bliley did lead to some amount of quote-unquote deregulation. But the deregulation I saw that was achieved with Graham Leach Bliley was the opportunity of these financial firms to diversify, and as I look around, those that diversified weathered the storm better than those that didn't. Otherwise, what I've seen in the last quarter of a century is Sarbanes-Oxley of 2002, the Fiducia Act of 1991, the HOPA Act of 1994, the 89 and 02 expansions of HMDA, the 2001 Bank Secrecy Act, the Fair and Accurate Credit Transaction Act of 03, the Bankruptcy of Use Prevention and Consumer Protection Act of 05, and the various TILA, Reg Z, and other federal banking guidance over the years. And then, again, most importantly, HUD's GSE's affordable housing mandates steadily increased throughout the 1990s and all the way through 2008. So if anything, there has been increased regulation over the last quarter of a century. And we also know that regulators don't always get it right. Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, regulated by the SEC. Wachovia, formerly the nation's fourth largest bank, regulated by the OCC. Countrywide, and this came as a news flash to the gentlelady of California, Maxine Waters, who heads up our housing committee on financial services. She was under the impression that they were not a regulated entity when, in fact, they were first regulated by the OCC and then later as a federal thrift under the OTS. I could go on and on and on. Let's examine each one of these participants and, looking forward, federal policies that may be considered to help lessen. We should never engage in the folly of believing that somehow we will outlaw financial panics, that we will outlaw recessions, but at least mitigate the opportunities for them to happen again. Again, I believe in retrospect, and we all know that former Chairman Greenspan has taken a contrary opinion. I believe he had an editorial recently in the Wall Street Journal. But I think, again, the case can be made that there was a point in overreacting, I believe, to the dot-com bubble burst and 9/11 that flooded the markets with liquidity. And it wasn't just the Fed. You have to look at our trade deficit as well. But we were awash in liquidity, and in a real inflation-adjusted terms, the Fed was giving money away. They were paying you to take this money to go and do something with it. My fear with respect to the Federal Reserve is the Federal Reserve has too many charges. Not only does it have the charge of price stability, it has the charge of consumer protection. Theoretically, it has the charge of taxpayer protection. Theoretically, it has the charge, in some respects, of bank regulator. And now there are some in Congress who want to add systemic regulator to that list. I believe that what we need to do is assure that the Fed is focused on one and only one issue. And I believe that we need the Fed to have inflation targets as its policy. I support Paul Ryan's Price Stability Act of 2008, which, among other things, would repeal Humphrey Hawkins and require the Fed to set a numerical definition for price stability and maintain that policy. I'm also concerned as the Fed continues to exercise its 13-3 exigent circumstance power, that although I desperately do not want to politicize the Fed, I do not want Congress to micromanage the Fed, but as the printing presses are being turned on as we speak, there must be limits under this 13-3 exigent circumstance power to allow them without any checks or balances whatsoever, except to look themselves in the mirror and say this has something to do with systemic risk. Their ability to inflate the currency and lead to an untold amount of taxpayer exposure liability must be limited. And I believe we must look at the limits of its balance sheet and the duration of its portfolio. Beyond that, I think we have to look again at federal policies that I believe, again, regardless of how noble they were in intent, ultimately had the philosophy not of trying to expand the economic opportunities of the borrower, but instead to bring down the lending standards of the lender. And I believe, as I've put before, that essentially Fannie and Freddie were morphed into an off-budget HUD. Here's the deal, Fannie and Freddie. We are going to grant you a duopoly. We are going to allow you to make profits that your competitors can't because you can borrow money for 50 basis points or whatever else the market will allow with the implicit guarantee. But here's the quid pro quo. Ultimately, you must securitize mortgages for people who can't afford to be in homes. And the worse condition that Fannie and Freddie found themselves in, the worst mortgages they chose to underwrite. That has led to an explosion that has brought down this entire economy. I think that it is time to repeal CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act. Again, regardless of how noble its original intent was, and I believe it did have a noble intent, I think it is, number one, a historic relic. Now, although CRA, when it comes to numbers, was a small part of the subprime and Alt-A mortgages, it was huge in the matter of putting the federal government good housekeeping seal of approval onto having bankers lower their lending standards. It said this is an approved activity. Banking regulators approve of this type of activity. And indeed, it caught on in the market once it received that stamp of approval. The time has come for CRA to leave, particularly any person in America who has access to a public library, has access to the Internet, and has access to untold numerous financial institutions and the availability to access credit. Back to the GSEs. GSEs were neither fish nor fowl, as we all know. They were an institution that was allowed to privatize their profits and socialize their losses. In the last Congress, I introduced legislation that over an orderly period of 5 to 7 years would either, one, put them out of conservatorship into receivership, and ultimately send them back to the marketplace. I know elections have consequences. I know that that is not possible today. But if that is not possible, they need to revert back to their status before President Johnson turned them into this neither fish nor fowl status, and turn them back into a wholly owned government agency that does not hold its paper in portfolio and does not attempt to privatize its profits and socialize its losses. Again, I think that there was a role played by the oligopoly of the credit rating agencies. The SEC should have never had this designation. We want competition within the marketplace, and we must ensure that this NRSRO designation no longer prohibits competition for those who are attempting to rate these securities. As long as we are going to have government-insured securities and mortgages, there must be a different standard for the purpose of taxpayer protection. When you look at the securitization process, clearly a big problem was people did not have skin in the game. I believe that we're going to have legislation to, number one, if we're dealing with a federally insured mortgage, then the mortgage originator's payout must be not immediate, but paid out over several years so that they have skin in the game. I think that the days of zero down and 5% down are over. If the taxpayer is going to be called upon to bail out individuals and institutions, again, the borrower must have skin in the game. I think there was a huge problem as well with fair value accounting. Now, having said that, I'm not shooting at the accountants. I do not want Congress to practice accounting. If you've looked at the federal debt, they're not particularly good at it. I can assure you my colleagues are not qualified to do this, and it's not so much fair market value accounting. I do not wish to make balance sheets more opaque. But I think that we are going to have legislation dealing with how our regulators invoke the reserve requirements in times of economic distress. Because as interpreted by our financial institution regulators, fair market value accounting de facto has led to a credit crunch death spiral. And I think but for its improper application, since it is very difficult to mark something to market when there is no market, has terribly exacerbated the economic conditions that we have seen. So I think that indeed we must have our regulators not make balance sheets more opaque, but become more realistic in times of economic stress so that they do not become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Last but not least, I believe that the best anecdote is economic growth. I am fearful that there are many in Congress today who are simply having an ideological knee-jerk reaction against exactly the economic policies necessary to lift us out of this economic turmoil. House conservatives, for example, support legislation that would absolutely zero out the capital gains tax for the next 2 years. Nothing would be more helpful. In addition, there is at least $1 trillion, I believe, sitting on the sideline, but investors are waiting to see which way the prevailing winds blow in Washington. We must have at least some amount of legislative and regulatory certainty before we can move forward. Finally, I believe that the American people need to know that ultimately the answers to our economic challenges do not lie within the halls of Congress. They do not lie on Wall Street. They lie with the small businesses of Main Street. We need tax relief for small businesses so they can preserve the jobs they have today, grow more jobs tomorrow. And as painful and as difficult as it will be to work out of this recession, America has faced greater challenges in the past, and I have no doubt that we will come out of this. With the right policies, we will come out quicker. With the wrong policies, we could be in for a long haul. Thank you very much. I got time for a few questions.
So we have time for a couple of questions, and I think somebody with a microphone. And Bert, you get the first question. But you have to introduce yourself.
Bert Ely, a banking consultant here in town. Thank you very much for being with us today. Picking up on your point about the low down payment, no down payment loans, of course, we have various federal programs, including FHA, that are premised on the notion of very little, if any, down payment. What specific reforms would you propose in that area with regard to federally assisted mortgages, federally insured mortgages, specifically FHA mortgages, as to what the absolute minimum down payment should be on those mortgages?
Given the level of economic turmoil caused, if we're going to have a federally insured mortgage, I believe in 20% down. You didn't know a politician was capable of a quick answer.
You get an applause for a short answer there. Other questions before I know the congressman has to go do some votes. So, other questions for him here? One in the back, right behind you.
Congressman Hensley, J.W. Verrett from the Mercatus Center. My question is, given the overwhelming participation of banks in TARP, the fact that we're basically a control shareholder, over 200 banks, how can we prevent going in the wrong direction in terms of not just Fannie and Freddie, but the entire banking industry following the philosophy, as you mentioned, of privatizing profits but socializing losses? What particular things can we do that maybe overseers and maybe Treasury isn't doing that you think maybe need to be done?
Well, unfortunately, elections have consequences. So we're going to have to keep hope alive at least through next November. I think you raise a very, very valid fear. I think the TARP program essentially will father potentially hundreds of new Fannies and Freddies. Again, if you look very closely at what Barney Frank has proposed and done on the Financial Services Committee. And listen, I respect the man, and he's quite an intellect. He's trying to take America 180 degrees removed from where I'm trying to take America. But number one, if you look at the legislation he attempted to pass in the House, that legislation would put a federal observer into every boardroom of every institution that either takes TARP money directly or indirectly, which means potentially a community bank in Athens, Texas, that I represent in the 5th Congressional District of Texas, Joe's Garage, which employs 12 people, one day could have a federal observer knock on his door, I'm here to see how you're using the TARP money that you borrowed from the First National Bank of Athens, Texas. Today's federal observer becomes tomorrow's federal suggester, which becomes next week's federal mandator. So number one, we have to know that. Second of all, and listen, I don't want to put any artificial limits on the American dream, but when taxpayer money is involved, these bonuses indeed are outrageous. I know that's the word of the week. I know it's been exercised. But what you see is this morphing into, once the government gets its claws into these institutions, then they're going to set the compensation limits. Already you've heard Chairman Franks say he wants to start firing people at AIG, and I'm sure he's very well capable of running AIG. I've seen in another context my colleagues tell the big three automaker execs on what kind of cars they need to make to become profitable. I mean, I don't know if that's comedy, tragedy, or farce, but I cannot think of any institution less qualified. So I'm very fearful about it. Here would be my view. Number one, I voted against the TARP program once. I voted against it twice. It's not to say I didn't believe there was a legitimate emergency, which, by the way, I hear that word every day. This was one of the few times I actually believed it. Many of you know that I rank rather high on fiscal conservative ratings in the Congress. I was willing, reluctantly, to put the full faith and credit of the United States, backed up by the taxpayer, at least in some form or fashion, to help get us out of the economic turmoil. But the role of the federal government should not be one that nationalizes these companies and runs these companies, but it needs to be in the nature of the FDIC. And that is, be the receiver, come in, and sell off the profitable assets, fire sell the rest, and let's quit propping up the failed financial institutions of the past, and let's create a path of opportunity for the financial institutions of the future. So I would do a couple of things. Number one, I would say, you can qualify, anybody who wants TARP money, your executives can qualify for the biggest bonus in the universe, but not one penny will be paid until the taxpayer is made whole. All the interest is paid on the debt. We get a decent rate of return on the equity, number one. Number two, if you're going to come to Uncle Sam and you're not a bank, a federal bank that's already under the auspices of the FDIC, there is going to be a tripwire where we can put you into receivership. We are not going to continue to throw good money after bad. I don't want people lining up for TARP money. I want people lining up to pay the TARP money back. So I think a combination of those two, and frankly, a number of them are trying to pay it back. What was it that Dick Armey used to say, that when you get into a partnership with the devil, remember you're the junior partner? I think a number of these financial institutions have awakened to the fact that if they're going to get in partnership with the United States Congress, they are the junior partner. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I don't think that. Thank you, Congressman. We're going to invite the other panel members up now. They're just exchanging notes to see who's going to give which speech. Let me introduce quickly the next three panel members. Our next panel member is going to be David Birenbaum, who's the Executive Vice President of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He oversees the NCRC's Fair Lending and Fair Housing Initiatives. He's a noted advocate on consumer protection and civil rights issues, and I expect when he speaks he will agree with Congressman Henserling on absolutely every point. Next, we're going to have John Weicker. John is the director of the Husman Institute's Center for Housing and Financial Markets. He's a former Assistant Secretary for Housing and former Federal Housing Commissioner at HUD. He's also a former Assistant Secretary for Policy Development and Research at HUD and a former Chief Economist at HUD and at OMB. And then our third speaker will be Alex Pollack, who is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a former president and CEO of the Federal Home Loan Bank of Chicago. He writes extensively and frequently on housing, finance, accounting standards, and government-sponsored enterprises. David, you have the floor.
Thank you. This has been an amazing conversation this morning, and I'm very appreciative of the Federalist Society to have us, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, my colleague Jim Carr and I here. In fact, there is a lot that I think, whether one is a consumer advocate or a believer, that frankly the strength of our economy comes from a robust business community, that we do agree upon. My role today is, to some extent, to respond quickly to some of the remarks of the congressman, to address some concerns, but also I want to incorporate some of the remarks that were made earlier today. For example, with regard to rating agencies, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition is in full agreement that the system, which has perpetuated the role of a rating agency in our society to be literally an empower of some of these problematic loans, to in fact be the facilitator of the problem, is a real and a crucial regulatory issue that needs to be addressed. NCRC has filed 3 grievances, civil rights grievances, to the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, tracking the role of the rating agencies in perpetuating not just the non-prime lending marketplace, but frankly the role of option arms and other, quote, toxic products in our marketplace. We are facing a serious issue in our society, and it is not limited to non-prime. The issue has become very mainstream, very middle class, reaching from the low to moderate income roots of the issue, where non-prime loans were targeted, were steering, where discrimination was taking place, to one which has reached middle America. If you look at new home purchases over the past 4 years, over 80% of those new homeowners are now in upside-down mortgages. And in fact, if we can trust Credit Suisse and their estimations for the coming few years, if unemployment is over 8%, there will be 8 million foreclosures in this nation in the next 4 years. Last week, you may have read, what is the unemployment rate? 8.1%, and expected to go as high as 10%. Credit Suisse has informally adjusted their numbers up now to 10 million foreclosures. We will not address the economic crisis that we are in until we have addressed the underlying issues of what has brought us here. In all of the discussion about the banks, we have to go back to sound underwriting. In fact, we can do what we will to reorganize, to re-regulate, but unless there are sound protections, unfortunately, we do need to legislate sound underwriting. These no-income verification loans, all of the option arm loans that were originated without looking at the adjusted rate, what the adjusted payment would be, they have led to a crisis in our nation, and unfortunately, the word greed is the appropriate word to be using. We need to legislate good business sense in America again, whether it's for a short term or a long term. H.R. 3915 is being reconsidered at this time by Chairman Frank, as well as the Republicans on the House Financial Services Committee. I testified just a little over a week ago before the congressman, and we raised that issue. We'll also agree, though we have a slightly different tact, that CRA, the Community Reinvestment Act, should be reexamined in the future. And in fact, just over a week ago, Congressman Eddie Bernice Jones and Congressman Gutierrez, Congresswoman and Congressman, introduced the CRA Modernization Act of, in fact, 2009. The evidence is overwhelming, whether you look at reports from the Federal Reserve, whether we look to, in fact, remarks and testimony from the American Bankers Association last week, or many other neutral third-party sources, CRA has not been the problem. Frankly, it is the antidote. If every institution that has now disappeared was in fact regulated by the Community Reinvestment Act, we would not be in the mess that we are in right now. With all due respect to the Congressman's remarks, Countrywide's regulated footprint was extremely small for their federal banking institution. They were a large, unregulated financial service corporation. New Century, Ameriquest, and all the other names that are no longer with us were not adequately regulated. And this gets to the direct part of the conversation we're dealing with today. What are the underlying issues? Preemption. Is it federal law? Is it state law that applies? Assignee liability. What's wrong with assignee liability if everyone is acting as a responsible player in the marketplace? These are the skeletons in the closet that are driving a lot of the discussions that we're having right now on regulatory and statutory reform. CRA modernization proposes that, in fact, responsible lending, that is the first and number one criteria of the Community Reinvestment Act, will reach every player in the marketplace, from, in fact, the Wall Street Investment Bank to large national credit unions to banks, financial service corporations, and even insurers. The issues of responsible lending are very, very important, and I submit to you that strong consumer protection and responsible lending create a strong economy, and, in fact, they are synonymous. There are real issues that we're facing. They're ongoing right now. I'm sure many of you, simply commuting back and forth from work, have heard the numbers. Call us. We can help you with your foreclosure problems. And the various companies are advertising that for a fee, they can assist homeowners. Well, frankly, a homeowner can go directly to their servicer. They can go directly to Hope Now. They can go to any HUD-certified counseling agency. And you know what they pay for the exact same service? Zero. Do you know the number of complaints coming in against these scams right now? They're exploding. The use of broker price opinions document another issue in the failures of the marketplace. Appraisers are regulated, frankly, on a state level. But the pressure to inflate valuation during the mortgage crisis was high on every level, both national, state, and local. Federal regulators tried and failed to address the issue. It brought a case by Attorney General Cuomo to address valuation issues, best practices between Fannie and Freddie, which have now brought litigation from industry sources claiming these best practices to try to ensure objective appraisals, in fact, do not be realized. Now, what's the point now? Well, then the pressure was up on the marketplace. You know what's happening now? Broker price opinions are being used routinely by servicers, by, in fact, others. Those are issued by realtors. They are, in fact, providing a service to, in fact, the management or the servicer who owns the REO properties. It is a race to the bottom. There, they have a conflict of interest. The brokers, in fact, are also the folks selling or auctioning the property. So if the number is lower, in fact, the property is sold faster. That impacts on the tax base. All of these issues are real issues. The issue with the rating agencies is not solely First Amendment. The issue with CRA isn't whether or not unqualified consumers became homeowners. It is, in fact, responsible lending practice, ensuring that all of the regulators have a place at the table. To close, what I have seen in my work at the National Community Reinvestment Coalition and elsewhere is such a thicket of rules and regulation that not only are lenders in a maze, so are consumers and politicians. We need to find the balance between a federal standard as well as a substantially equivalent state standard so that, like environmental law and other civil rights protections, we have equal standards and enforcement that's clear and transparent to all. Only then will we begin to restore trust to the marketplace. Thank you.
I also think that this has been a very stimulating conference, a number of knowledgeable people with insightful things to say, and I am almost the last speaker, one more to go after me. And I thought I would start by talking about something that happened a long time ago that helps explain how we got to this mess and what implications it might have for what we should and should not be doing. And this concerns the GSEs, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And Congressman Hensarling talked about them. I want to talk about something that he did not go into, and it is related to a point touched on by Dean Canova this morning. You may not remember, some of you are too young to remember, that from 1989 to 1992, the Secretary of HUD was the regulator of the GSEs and also sat on the Federal Housing Finance Board. He was as close to a single regulator of the housing finance system as we had. That was Jack Kemp. I was his assistant secretary for policy development research, and my research staff included HUD's economist. So Secretary Kemp asked me to create a staff that could support him in his new regulatory responsibilities, and I did, and I managed the staff for him. We were required to prepare annual reports on the GSEs by legislation, and one of those reports was a capitalization study, which was done in 1991. We looked at how much capital did the GSEs actually have, and how much did they need to survive a downturn in the housing market or in the economy, an analytical procedure known as a stress test. Congress was very concerned about capital adequacy for mortgage lenders. Excuse me. This was right after FIREA, in the midst of closing down the failed SNLs. We based our stress test on a scenario from Moody's, a depression scenario which they used to rate private mortgage insurers. It was a 10-year scenario. It basically consisted of 1 year of flat housing prices, then four straight years of prices falling at 10% a year, followed by 5 years of stable to very slightly rising prices. No further decline, but no bounce back either. The analysis concluded that the GSEs could survive about 7 years of this scenario. The GSEs took great exception. They said they could survive 10 years. Now, the reason this mattered was that if a company survived the stress test for 10 years, Moody's rated it AAA. If it only survived 7 years, it was rated AA. The GSEs had recently had a brush with Standard & Poor's, which rated them AA in the absence of their implicit government guarantee. The GSEs had gone to the mat with Standard & Poor's, and Standard & Poor's had pulled back. So they didn't want this issue coming up again. Now, the HUD analysis was based on the GSEs continuing to buy mortgages for 2 years after the downturn started, and also maintaining their fee structure. After 2 years, they'd stop buying mortgages, but they'd lose money on the mortgages they owned, and eventually they'd go bust, go bankrupt in 7 years. The GSEs argued that they would stop buying mortgages as soon as the downturn started, immediately. And they'd raise their guarantee fees and service charges, and they'd survive 10 years. And HUD responded, how do you know exactly when the Depression starts? You don't know that until it's been underway for a while. As you perhaps noticed, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which officially charts the business cycles, concluded about 2 months ago that the current recession actually started last January of 2008. And I'd also asked, if you raise fees, how do you square that with your Charter Act responsibility to provide stability in the secondary mortgage market during a downturn? Well, to my mind, we won the argument analytically and we lost it politically. In 1992, Congress passed FEFSA, the Federal Housing Enterprise Financial Safety and Soundness Act, and they put in a stress test for the GSEs, but it was much less severe than the Depression scenario. It was based on the oil patch downturn of the early 1980s. They also put in a 2% minimum capital requirement, which everybody said was very low. They figured the 2% would be a kind of temporary requirement until the new regulator put the stress test in place, and then the stress test would require more capital. Their stress test was very complicated. It took the new regulator more than 5 years to put it in place and evaluate the GSEs. And then it turned out that the test was so weak that it required less than the 2% minimum capital, which was sort of embarrassing. Well, we now know the outcome of that controversy from about 20 years ago. Turns out that we at HUD were optimistic. The GSEs could not survive 3 years of the Depression scenario, barely two. House prices flattened out in mid-2006 and started turning down in the summer of 2007, dropping since 2007 at a rate of less than 10% a year, about 7%. And by the summer of 2008, the GSEs were in great trouble, and by fall 2008, they were in conservatorship. And the GSEs certainly did not stop buying mortgages when the downturn started. They kept on buying when other financial institutions were moving out of the market, and they didn't have enough capital to last 3 years. They did raise their fees in late 2008, though. They did part of it. Now, why does this matter? It's always useful to know how we got to where we are, but it has some lessons for where we are going. The GSEs will not hold any more capital than they have to. The HUD stress test indicated that Fannie should have about 35% more capital than it did. Freddie should have had more than double. The GSEs didn't want that. They wanted to rely on the government guarantee instead of the discipline of the capital markets. And if we have the GSEs going forward, we will have that same battle again. And despite Representative Hensarling's legislation, we may very well have the GSEs going forward. There is a great deal of concern about who's going to make mortgage loans. Right now, as you read in the paper every day, nobody but the government is in the business of making mortgage loans. But even beyond that, having a specialized housing lender has been national policy since the 1930s. Now, it hasn't worked very well since the inflation of the mid-1960s. Once that started, it took the SNLs about 15 years to collapse. And then when the GSE stepped in to be the specialized housing lender, it took them about 20 years to collapse. Now, creating GSEs is a tricky business. We have had them in housing, in agriculture, in education. We know about the housing problems now. You may remember the agricultural credit problem some 20 years ago with the farm credit system, which had to have a restructuring and recapitalization. And in education, Congress has been back and forth on how to make loans to college students, and Sallie Mae went private. There are three kinds of risk that you're going to confront in the mortgage market if you're a lender: interest rate risk, credit risk, operations risk. And the GSEs have now run into all three. In the 1980s, Fannie Mae had interest rate risk. We talked this morning about borrowing short and lending long. What both Bert and Wayne talked about that. It was also the case that if you're making mortgage loans, you can borrow short at a low rate and lend long, and then the short rate goes up on you. And that's what happened to Fannie Mae between the late 70s and the early 80s. They had borrowed at a rate less than the cost of the mortgage, but they borrowed short, and the mortgage rate and the short-term borrowing rate went up on them. In the early years of this decade, we had operations risk. Remember Freddie Mac's accounting problems, trying to smooth out their earnings, and Fannie Mae trying to manipulate its earnings so that the top executives would get very large bonuses, which apparently is still continuing. And now we have credit risk, having loans that went bad, not knowing what they were doing. So we have had the biggest players in our housing finance system, the duopoly, making all the mistakes that it is possible to make, generic mistakes that it's possible to make in the business of making mortgage lending. And if we recreate the same kind of institutions with the same kind of risks, then the younger members of the Federalist Society may get to hold another conference like this one, maybe in another couple of decades, maybe sooner. Thank you.
I'm beginning with this quote in honor of my friend Wayne Abernathy, who is a Civil War expert. William Tecumseh Sherman, before he was a famous general and a great war hero, was a banker. He ran a bank in San Francisco, and he was there for the collapse in the panic of 1857. He commented afterwards he couldn't understand why anybody would want to be involved in a business, quote, subject to such vicissitudes, unquote. Well, some of us find these vicissitudes and the inevitable political reactions to them quite fascinating. I suppose it's developed taste. In his great book, Crisis and Leviathan, Robert Higgs points out that every crisis induces an expansion of the intrusion of the government into life, and that it's to some extent a one-way ratchet, that the expansion, although it may retreat a little after the crisis, never goes back to where it was before. So that if you look over the long-term history, you have this constant ratcheting up. And it's hard to roll it back. Thus, the excellent question for our panel, how do we reprivatize credit? Since, needless to say, in credit markets now, we are seeing a truly vast expansion of governmentalization of credit. Now, a good example historically of this ratchet effect is deposit insurance. Here is what the two main sponsors of the Banking Act of 1933, Senator Glass and Congressman Stegall, had to say about the fundamental nature of deposit insurance. Senator Glass said, "This is not a government guarantee of deposits. The government is involved only in an initial subscription to the capital of a corporation that will pay a dividend to the government on its investment. This is not a government guarantee." And Congressman Stegall, the other sponsor, said, "I do not mean to be understood as favoring government guarantee of bank deposits. I do not. I have never favored such a plan." Well, if we look at the FDI sticker by the teller window of each local bank, we will now see that on that sticker for all to see, it says, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. And there's a good example of this ratchet effect. Thinking about how we go forward into reprivatization, I have three general directions I'd like to suggest. One, the creation of new banks should be a national priority. Second, we have to have a system that creates much larger loan loss reserves in good times. And finally, we have to have the ultimate disappearance of the GSE form for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Starting off with new banks, we want to encourage the creation and capitalization of brand new banks because we need new sources of credit. Now is a great time to start new banks when so many old ones are constrained by the deadweight burden of bad loans and unfortunate decisions in the past. So if you had some capital and you thought you might want to put it into banking, even remembering General Sherman's thought about vicissitudes, which would you rather invest in? A new bank with a fresh opportunity to make loans into the very wide credit spreads of today with the very high credit standards of today? Or would you like to invest in an old bank sinking in bad loans and losses, entangled with the government as senior partner, as the congressman so rightly said, who is busy helping you cut executive salaries and force loan modifications under your portfolio? Well, that's a pretty easy decision, isn't it? But the American regulators today, as opposed to encouraging new banks, are doing precisely the opposite. They are standing in the way, they are stonewalling, and they are trying to prevent this from happening. Why? Because they want to force new capital to solving their problem of having put government guarantees on old banks, and they want to channel any new capital into old deals, into restructurings. From their narrow point of view, it's easy to see why you'd take that position, but from the perspective of the broad functioning of credit markets, new unencumbered banks are what we need. This has happened before in periods of financial stress. I'll just quickly mention two notable cases. One is the creation of an entire system of federal savings and loans from scratch, from nothing, during the 1930s, and of course the creation of an entire system of national banks during the 1860s. I don't think we need a brand new charter like those two cases, but it would be handy to reduce the burdens of being a bank holding company. We might be able to get some truly sizable, big new capital committed to new banks, and this would be highly useful for creating credit and for expanding credit on a private basis. Second major idea. In good times, we need much bigger loan loss reserves if we want to have a system made up of private credit risk bearing. A system of extremely high leverage, by extremely high leverage, I mean assets to equity of 12 to 1, 15 to 1, 20, let alone 25, 30, as we see in some places. A system of high leverage is bound to fail periodically. As the night, the day, if you run a system of high leverage, you will have periodic panics and busts. And this is even more true if you lever up during the boom and don't build up the reserves. One way to have lower leverage, lower real leverage, is to build up the loan loss reserve. If you don't build up those loan loss reserves when the inevitable busts come, you will be in the government's clutches. This was nicely stated by George Champion, who was the chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank when it was a leading bank in the 1960s. In an interview in 1978, Champion suggested that banks should increase the reserve for bad debts to a point of having at least 5% of loans in the loan loss reserves. And he observed in 1978, three decades ago, that the losses and charge-offs of the last few years, namely the crisis of the mid-70s, clearly justify such a level of reserves. He continued, "Don't apply for privileges in Washington. You lose your strength. You lose your independence." How right he was. He concluded, "Don't get in a position where you're going to have to rely on the government to bail you out." As a crusty old banker said to me long ago, bad loans are made in good times. This eternal truth, bad loans are made in good times, is all you need to know to understand why the accounting theoreticians of the SEC and the FASB are wrong yet again when it comes to loan loss reserves. Their argument is that in days of big profits, of bumper profits, you'll be creating a cookie jar and managing earnings, What they don't understand is that those days of bumper profits are illusions. They're not real. They're not real because bad loans are made in good times and generate illusory profits. Those illusory profits lead to big bonuses, big dividends, and worst of all, big stock buybacks, making capital disappear in the financial system based on the illusion of earnings of the good times. So during those good times, we got to be building up the reserves to much bigger levels and with more old-fashioned reserves. And there's nothing more old-fashioned than this idea. We had down payments. That's an old-fashioned and good idea. Now we got big reserves. That's an old-fashioned and good idea. With such old-fashioned reserves, we'll do better in the next cycle at keeping credit private. A third, Fannie and Freddie, we need to make their existence as GSEs end. Now, a key point about Fannie and Freddie is that the ongoing bailout of these two organizations is without question an intervention to save an intervention. It's not an intervention to save a private company. It's an intervention to save a government intervention, namely Fannie and Freddie. What are we going to do with them now? Well, in my view, you have two phases. For the present, Fannie and Freddie have already become part of the government. They're not GSEs. They're government housing banks. By the way, the worldwide experience with government housing banks is disastrous as a long-term project. But that's what Fannie and Freddie are. But long as they are government housing banks, they are available to be directed by the government to refinance the mortgage bust based on political policy and not profit. That's what's happening. And in the bust, you might want to do that temporarily. Jim Lockhart, the director of the FHFA, his real title is CEO of both Fannie and Freddie. And there, that's where we are today. This government housing bank status should be temporary, as I said. Should have a firm sunset 4 or 5 years from now. And at that point, we should have, in my view, a long-term restructuring, which would deal with the following three parts of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Prime mortgage securitization, for which in the 21st century you do not need any kind of government intervention, should just become a private business. Sink or swim, flourish or fail, see how you do. The business of owning a leveraged portfolio of mortgage loans and mortgage-backed securities should just be chartered as a bank, or maybe you want to set it up as a real estate investment trust. Again, simply part of the private market. Sink or swim, succeed or fail. The final element of the former Fannie and Freddie consists of those activities which are properly those of the government, such as providing housing subsidies in one form or another, providing non-market financing of risky loans. These should not be a GSE. They should be in the government. Their funding in this form will have to be honestly appropriated by the Congress. We all love transparency these days. We need some transparency in this activity of creating subsidized housing and subsidized loans. So you just keep this in the government, and the Congress, if it wants, can honestly and transparently appropriate the funds to do this instead of having a hidden conduit, which you let the GSEs do this, as Congressman Hensarling said so rightly, in exchange for some other bennies that they get. So in my view, these governmental functions of Fannie and Freddie should be simply merged into the structures of FHA and Ginnie Mae. And when you get done with these three changes, note, there's no GSE left. And that is a consummation devoutly to be wished. In summary, I propose these three projects toward the reprivatization of credit, this great question that the panel posed. One, a national program of hearty encouragement of the creation of new banks. Two, going forward in the good times, lower leverage through much higher realistic loss reserves, and finally ending in time the GSE status for Fannie and Freddie. And all of this would move us in the right reprivatization direction.
Well, all of our panelists have completed their remarks in their allotted time. When Tim Ganova was talking, he talked about putting the capital back into capitalism. We're really talking about putting the fund back into dysfunctional, which is the system we're dealing with now. When I taught constitutional law, there was a day where you would teach about state action. You would teach about when private activity was touched upon with government activity enough to make it like government. And I can see in the future we're going to have a day in con law classes called Private Action Day, when government activity is touched upon with enough private activity that we want to treat it differently. We have plenty of time for questions for our panel, and we have someone passing the mic around. We'll start with Dean Eastman.
Thanks, Mr. Barenbaum. You said we need to legislate good business sense. And maybe I'm reading more into that than you meant, but what I took you to mean is exactly the opposite of what I think we need to do. There is no possible way the government can legislate good business sense. I mean, this is like creating five-year plans. And I mean, the government gets it wrong more than the private sector does in every single instance. So rather, what I'm going to propose, I think we need to legislate a structure that would get profit and risk lined up again. Or like I talked about earlier on the spending clause, it gets the costs and the benefits lined up again. And let me give a couple of examples where we've done this wrong to catastrophic consequence. Our healthcare system. You know, we've gone to a third-party pay system where profit and loss or benefit and cost are not lined up. And our solution to that is to make it even further removed rather than get restored. The savings and loan crisis of the 1980s is a function of not lining profit and risk up. We privatized profit and socialized the risk. And our response to that this year has been, let's up the $100,000 FDIC guarantee to $250,000. That's exactly the wrong thing to do. And every time the government tries to legislate good business sense rather than the structure, it makes the problem worse.
I think, Dean, that you raise a good point, but allow me to respond in what I hope will be a thoughtful way. Unfortunately, we have seen over the past 5 to 8 years an expansion and misuse of products that when they were originally developed, they had a very legitimate business purpose. For example, the no-income verification loan for a private homeowner who is self-employed is a means to home ownership, and there were appropriate uses for that. The option ARM product was originally from the state of California, where lenders for a number of years, in fact, over a decade, your home state, right, used that product very effectively to address, frankly, some of the high-cost housing issues the state was facing. What happened, though, with those products, and it was compounded by problems of a dual lending marketplace, meaning that access to credit was problematic for members of our population, whether it was racially oriented, whether it was low-income individuals, regardless of their credibility, whatever, just because these are real issues in our society, that, in fact, the products began to grow in use across the country. And, in fact, lenders who had not had previous experience with these products were using them more and more frequently. Financial modernization kicked in as well at the same time. And where we were an environment where responsible banks, members of the American Bankers Association, who had a track record of beyond belief for responsible lending, they, in fact, were originating fewer and fewer loans. And at the same time, Wall Street, rather than Main Street, began to channel how loans were being securitized and originated. There was a lot of stimulus to originate loans, but frankly, there's a reason that mortgage brokers grew from about 20% of a marketplace to well over 75% of the marketplace. And where were they securitizing these non-traditional loan products, which in many cases, no doubt we'll find the majority of cases were inappropriate, they were being securitized to Wall Street with very little regulatory oversight. I actually agree with you that the market should be policing itself. In an ideal world, the market is creative. It is responsive to community needs. There is a sub-issue there. There have been issues of redlining in our history, of steering and pricing discrimination. It's why we have the laws that we do.
But the flip side of this, too, equally important, credit that's locked up in our marketplace right now, access to small business loans, college loans for students. All of these issues are intertwined right now. And so CRA, just to get back to the smokescreen and myths around CRA, calls for responsible lending. But it's not just about mortgage lending. It's small business loans. It's access to credit so that people can buy a car. It's where bank branches are located. It's how loans are, in fact, held and securitized for the long term. And it's a very responsible law that I think, at the very least, I'd invite everyone in the room to take a second look at. Do we have to legislate strong underwriting? My professional opinion is that the market has proven to me over the past 8 years, working with homeowners facing foreclosure, working with lenders who have overtly lied to me about how they are underwriting loans, is that unfortunately we need underwriting protections that industry and consumer groups agree upon to move ahead.
I don't know if either other panel member wants to jump in here, but
talked a good deal in this bust about greed, which of course has no explanatory power since greed is a constant. It's always there. And so is lying. A certain amount of lying always goes on by both borrowers, which is obvious, and also by brokers and lenders. And a certain amount of lying is always there. However, lying is not a constant. Lying historically, empirically expands in the boom. Frauds are one more pro-cyclical element, because in the optimism that you're going to be able to make investments in houses or dot-com stocks or whatever may have is the fashion of the moment, that induces the willingness to believe. The willingness to believe affects borrowers and lenders and investors and entrepreneurs, and part of the willingness to believe also induces fraud. Now, there is of course a discipline in market activity, but the ultimate discipline or policing, as was said, is failure. As my colleague Alan Meltzer said, markets or capitalism without failure is like religion without sin.
Being Jewish, I think you have to throw in guilt and shame as well. I do have to say, you know, when David was making his remarks, I was struck by the same line that Dean Eastman was about having to legislate good business sense, good business judgment. And I would think, you know, if we could do that, it would be a wonderful world, and I would like to tack on to that legislating good looks and hair regrowth. You know, if we can somehow do that at the same time. Yes, Bert. Just hang on 1 second. We have a mic coming to you.
Excuse me, sorry. Bert Ely. I want to pose the same question that I posed to the congressman, and that is, for homeowners, what do you consider to be a minimal acceptable amount of down payment, of skin in the game? And aren't we in an environment today where we're continuing to perpetuate the problem of insufficient skin in the game, particularly with even some of the recent revisions in the FHA down payment requirements?
Just one thing for questioners. If you want to pick on someone other than David, feel free. But David.
You know, I think your point about FHA is a real one. You may have seen in the newspapers that the number of defaults for consumers who have made simply one payment or actually failed to make one payment is skyrocketing right now in the FHA loan system. In our testimony before Congressman Hensarling's committee last week, we called for a federal investigation because that clearly is an indicator of fraud operating in the system. Several industry trade associations believe that it is a particular member of the free market doing it right now, and we don't need to go there in this conversation. Regardless, it's a problem that has to be examined. I think 80%
to respond directly to your question and to address the congressman's response, is too conservative right now. I mean, there is a long track record, for example, with responsible lenders doing traditional fixed-rate 30-year loans with PMI at 90%, for example. And I think that most lenders would agree that that has been a successful formula and product. Even the PMI companies who are taking dramatic losses right now have informed me that they feel 90%. Now, with certain other characteristics, in fact, it could even reach 95%. What I do not think works, and I'll be very candid, is no-income verification loans, HELOCs based on the rate at time of origination, option arms based at the rate at time of origination, and I'll add as well the use of very abusive piggyback loans and soft seconds out there. As well, another major issue is loans originated by home developers themselves. I mean, if we really begin to drill down more deeply into the high default rate in new home developments in Las Vegas and outside of Detroit, right in this community in Prince George's County, you will see that there was a real issue of inflated appraised value of these new developments when the surrounding housing stock was 25 to 40% less in value. All of these things impact on what is a sound loan and how we're underwriting it. And that's why we need to go back to basics, whether it's implemented by Wall Street, which when you think about when the whole crisis started, it's because, you know, basically people stopped investing. They were pulling out. Wall Street is the one who set the alarm here, not government. We were crying for 8 years. I mean, I testified before Sarbanes Committee, as Jim noted, 8 years ago, saying subprime raises safety and soundness issues for institutions. No one listened. I'm glad Wall Street raised the alarm. Now we got to fix it.
Yes.
Bert, one of the absolute regularities of all mortgage loan data is that loan-to-value ratios are a strong predictor of delinquencies and defaults. And so as leverage gets higher in the household, just as if leverage gets higher in any other sector, you're going to have more credit problems. So how much is too much? Well, we can say this: a 97.5% LTV loan, like an FHA loan, not even thinking about whether you're rolling the insurance premiums and the closing costs into the loan, is underwater when you walk away from the closing table. Because the bid price of your house is 95 the minute you've bought it, since it's going to cost you a minimum of 5% to sell it. So you're bid 95 and you owe 97.5 in the most optimistic case. So we can say that's too high. My view is, as a lender, I like big down payments because the empirical data is overwhelming in terms of the better performance of loans. But as a, if I were a making up the laws, I wouldn't legislate that, because I think it's fundamental to a free society that if people want to take risks, they should be able to. But they need to know what risks they're taking. If somebody wants to buy a big house and borrow a lot against it, and there's a lender willing to lend it to them, and what that means is you get to eat oatmeal for breakfast every day and hot dogs for dinner every night for 5 years, that's okay with me. But you better, we need a system that makes it very clear to both sides what we're actually talking about, so we're not fooling each other and fooling investors and fooling the system about the level of risk that we're deciding to take.
I think we have a question back here, and then Wayne, you're next.
Just looking briefly at what's going on in this city now, and all of the different sorts of agendas and proposals and 64-point plans that are floating around here, does any member of the panel have any great optimism that the economic crisis is going to be resolved by government action even in the next 5 years?
I'll jump in as a quick follow-up. Do you want to go first? Because you haven't spoken, John.
5 years? If it's still around in 5 years, we will have had a change in administration and a change in Congress. And if it's still around at that point, we may be having another change in Congress in 2014 and then going on. I don't think the crisis is going to last that long unless there's an absolutely terrible series of policy decisions. And I think whatever the mistakes that are being made now.
Why should I not expect?
Wait a minute. Bear with me a second. Whatever the mistakes are being made now, they're not the mistakes that were made in the Great Depression. We are not letting the banking system collapse. The Fed is not contracting the money supply. The Fed is doing its damnedest to get money out there. We may be running a very significant risk of inflation, not very far down the road. We are not. They're doing their very best to avoid a depression, and I think their best is certainly going to be good enough.
Dave, do you want to take a crack at that as well?
Well, I believe that the President's initiative to address foreclosure is a meaningful first step, but much of it, unless you were fortunate to have a Fannie or a Freddie held loan, they're going to refinance those loans in-house. But frankly, the rest of the program is very much a voluntary program. It's NCRC's belief that we need to use the market in partnership with the government to solve the issue. And Jim referenced our Help Now proposal to use the reverse auction process or eminent domain. And this is a part of our testimony as well. Now, eminent domain in the past has been a dirty word because it's taking a property. But here, the government would pool tranches of loans, frankly, modify those loans for the benefit of the consumers, and then sell them off to the private sector again. We believe that that step is probably going to be necessary. We're optimistic about this effort by the government to keep people in their homes and to address depreciation and all the other underlying elements. But unless we see some market-driven solutions, public-private sector together, we question whether we're going to get through this in the near future.
We had a question here, I think, Wayne. It's nice that people at AEI pour coffee for one another and say, you know, there are some people in the back of the room whose cups are empty.
Okay, I'll be over there in just a minute. It looks like that the Treasury is seriously giving consideration as part of their public-private partnership, if I'm reading between the lines correctly, the creation of a new GSE for the purpose of dealing with the assets of troubled financial institutions. As they're considering that, and if they're going to decide they want to go down that road, a couple of policy questions, not so much of whether they should, but if they're going to go down that road, are there ways to deal with that to make it more effective than it otherwise might be? Is a multiple GSE model better than just doing one GSE, maybe doing several? And the second question is, what kind of time horizon should be put on these to make sure these don't become perpetual GSEs?
You want to take first crack at that?
Duopoly is probably better than monopoly, and oligopoly is probably better than duopoly, but none of them are great ideas. And I think that's the idea of creating a new one when the old ones have gotten you into the position you are is remarkable perseveration, just repeating the same mistake over and over again. Nobody seemed to have any new idea there. I think back in the back of everybody's mind is the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which we all know, in quotes, took all the bad home mortgages and made money. What I think is not recognized is that while that is true, it's also the case that they did an awful lot of forbearance and they still had an awful lot of defaults. And in the period that they held those mortgages was a major war and a major inflation and a strong economy for quite a few years. We may have the major inflation. I trust we aren't going to have the major war. But I think you can't repeat that and make it work out the second time the way you think it worked out in the first.
Yes, Al.
Wayne, as somebody pointed out earlier, we're creating a whole lot of GSEs now through the TARP program. GSEs are a great example of the Robert Higgs ratchet notion. It's a lot easier to make them than to make them go away. John, one of the really good things about the Homeowners Loan Corporation was that it did actually go away. As its governing statute instructed the directors, when the objective is achieved, the organization shall liquidate and return any money to the Treasury, which it did. The other thing that was good about it was it had a limited it had a three-year limit on how long it could actually operate in terms of making loans, and they really did stick to it, 1933 to 36.
Yeah, with possibly the minority view in the room, I'm not sure, but I think we have to really forensically look at what happened to the government-sponsored enterprises. There was a lot of pressure brought on their board of directors, you know, as a public-private, quasi-governmental entity, to frankly produce more profit for those organizations. And they began to acquire the A-minus and lower quality non-traditional loan products. It wasn't really a question of what they were originating, more so what they were acquiring. I believe, frankly, FHA, despite why it was created, which was to help get access to credit to underserved communities, frankly, the government's record in running the FHA program is quite problematic. And I would be very hesitant to try to emulate a regulatory model, as has been suggested by some for Fannie and Freddie. NCRC's position is we would like to see changes to how the GSEs have operated, whether it be one, two, or more. That's really to us not the issue. But we do want a competitive marketplace that is led by private industry, responsible private lenders. But there is a place, we believe, to ensure access to credit for government through the GSEs.
I think it's no surprise that when you have government involved, there is political pressure brought to bear. When you have a lot of money at stake, it's no surprise that government is involved. And the other piece of the puzzle is when you talk about going out of business sunsetting. We do have experience with agencies that have been sunset. We have more experience with laws mandating sunsets where the sun sets further and further away. One of the agencies that I used to deal with, the FCC, was created as the Federal Radio Commission with a one-year lifespan. It is still going. I only hope that whoever is looking after my lifespan is as generous as government is with its creations. Do we have one more question for our panel before we let people go back to their desserts? Seeing and hearing none, I gather they have answered everything you could possibly think of. Our thanks to the panel, our thanks to the Federal Society and Chapman Law School, and thanks to the audience.